Our worship service incorporates each of the four earth elements: earth, water, air, and fire. In our stones and water ritual, the stones represent a joy, a care, a concern, a sorrow that you are carrying in your life at this time. Place it into the bowl of water, which represents this beloved community. Set down the stone. Allow this community to hold it with you. During our gathering hymn, number 212, you are invited to come forward, choose a stone, and place it into the bowl of water, one of which is on either aisle. Please rise now in body and spirit for singing "We Are Dancing Sarah's Circle." At this time, I would like anyone who is young or young at heart to come forward. I have some particular participants in mind. I am going to be talking this morning with the adults about a woman who fought for the rights of women to vote. And she did that in the 1800s. Come on forward and spread yourselves out in front here. Matilda Jocelyn Gage was born into a family in which her father was opposed to slavery, and he taught her the same values. And she practiced throughout her life protesting against various oppressions in the United States. And I just wanted you to see a few. I thought there were a couple more. But a few of the things that our children in this beloved community are concerned about here in at this time in our country. We have here, "End the Hate of All People," with a great big heart on it. I think you can agree with that. And then LGBTQ, "We Won't Go Back." That means we won't go back into hiding our lives from other people. Better health care. We all need better health care, and the kids recognize this. And they want you to help them, right? And this one says, "Take down the Trump wall." Now, that could be all kinds of walls, right? Not just one physical wall along a border, but all kinds of walls that we put up. And stop cutting down trees. These kids are concerned about the environment. They're concerned about climate change, and they're concerned about the number of species that are becoming extinct before our very eyes. You have been teaching these children what is important in for all of us to be working towards in terms of justice and equity and compassion. You have been teaching them, and they are teaching us. With that, I would invite us to sing the children to their classes, where they will learn even more about how to make their voices heard in this world. We are grateful for your gifts and contributions to this community, both monetary and physical, working for justice, working to end violence, especially that made in the hands of any one of us through the use of a gun. Thank you. The morning offering has been gratefully received. In the newspaper this week, there was an advertisement about the exhibit that just opened at the National Archives Museum, "Rightfully Hers, American Women and the Vote." It is a centennial celebration of the women's suffrage movement's efforts to achieve the right to vote. It examines their relentless, decades-long fight for ratification up to 1920, and looks beyond to the struggle of minority women who were originally left out to open the polls to all women. The flagship exhibit in Washington, D.C. is accompanied by a traveling exhibition in a national initiative to tell the suffrage story for one half of the citizens of this country founded on democratic ideals, including one person, one vote. The quest for truly equal rights for women is ongoing, as we well know. Women have always been treated poorly in religious and political systems based on patriarchal rule. Sometimes progress does happen. Take, for example, the recent news that Iceland has made it illegal to pay women less than men, according to Business Insider. Score one for the good guys and gals. There have been many notable women in this journey that seeks to reinstate respect of women's inherent worth and dignity that was part of ancient and indigenous matriarchal cultures. As Unitarian Universalists, we like to claim some of them as our own, including such notable women as Abigail Adams and Susan B. Anthony. Abigail Adams, wife of John Adams, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and mother of John Quincy Adams, the second and sixth presidents of the United States, respectively, is quoted as saying in 1776, "We are determined to foment a rebellion." We all know the names of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton as primary movers and shakers in the 19th century women's suffrage movement. But how many of you have ever heard of Matilda Electa Jocelyn Gage? I know that Kathy Sobrio has, but she's not here this morning. She was the third woman of this powerful women's rights trinity. There were many other women, too. Some of them we have heard of in more than a passing way, like the Quaker woman Lucretia Mott or the Unitarian woman Lucy Stone. Others are even less well known, such as Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, an early African-American Unitarian, who said in 1873, "As much as white women need the ballot, colored women need it more." Or Ernestine L. Rose, a Polish immigrant of Jewish background whose compelling oratory linked women's rights, the abolition of slavery, and religious freedom. A picture of Rose hung on Susan B. Anthony's wall, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton eulogized her as indispensable. I became acquainted with Matilda Jocelyn Gage during my internship year in Binghamton, New York. On one of several day trips that I made to Syracuse, I went to nearby Fayetteville to visit her historic home and the cemetery where there is a grave marker memorializing her. In addition to learning about Gage herself, I learned that her son-in-law was L. Frank Baum, the author of the 15 Oz books, from The Wizard of Oz, Wonderful Wizard of Oz in 1900, to Glinda of Oz in 1920. Baum was, or is, a complex and contradictory person whose connections with his mother-in-law and with Susan B. Anthony were sympathetically channeled by Baum into his Oz books, but who seems not to have been as swayed by Matilda Gage's relationship with the abolitionist and Native American rights movements of the time period. So who is Matilda Jocelyn Gage? Sally Rush Wagner, the executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation and a lecturer in women's studies, brings Gage and her better-known women's rights ally, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, to life through her writing and historical performances. I've drawn heavily upon Ms. Wagner's publications in the preparation of this sermon. Matilda Electa Jocelyn was born in 1826 in Cicero, north of Syracuse, near Lake Oneida. She was an only child, raised in a household dedicated to anti-slavery. Her father, Dr. Hezekiah Jocelyn, was a nationally known abolitionist, and the Jocelyn home was a station on the Underground Railway. Thwarted in her attempt to break the gender barrier and gain admittance to Geneva Medical College, Matilda married Henry Hill Gage at 18 years of age and started a family that would include her four children. When the Gage family moved to Fayetteville in 1854, their home also became a stop on the Underground Railroad. Excuse me just a second. The very first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls was organized quickly and advertised locally in 1848. Gage didn't hear about it, and she was busy with a newborn infant at the time. The second session in New York State was held in Rochester, where Susan B. Anthony lived, but Anthony did not attend because she thought women's rights was a foolish issue. Her family attended, however. These were followed by other local conventions and eventually, in 1850, yearly national conventions. The eventual triumvirate of Anthony, Stanton, and Gage did not show up until after the National Convention of 1852, the third one, which was held in Syracuse. Lucretia Mott presided over the meeting. Gage prepared a speech for that convention. She was the youngest woman on the platform, untrained and unpracticed in the art of public speaking. Gage spoke about the achievements and capabilities of women in all arenas of life, despite a history of discrimination. She proposed a solution to women's subordinate position that was both personal and political. Women must be educated for self-respect and economic self-reliance at the same time that the institutions that perpetuated their oppression required changing. After Gage's speech, Anthony tried to restrict speakers to those who could project to the back of the hall filled with an audience of 2,000. However, the next scheduled speaker objected to such a gag rule, which would simply perpetuate the tyranny that women came here to destroy. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Matilda Jocelyn Gage were not exactly three peas in a pod. Their respective personalities, circumstances, and the dynamics of their relationships all influenced the way that they worked together. According to Sally Rorsch Wagner, Anthony quickly became an organizer for the movement and attended most state and national conventions. Think of it. She crisscrossed the country in the second half of the 19th century without the convenience of modern air travel. Anthony didn't have children, and she had the financial means to do so. Stanton, on the other hand, hated conventions, avoiding every one that she could. She stayed at home with her large family as an excuse and wrote. Anthony preferred to trust in the eagerly given advice of Stanton on matters of strategy and theory. And Anthony delivered Stanton's convention addresses, at least until Stanton's children were grown and she began delivering her own speeches. Meanwhile, Gage was writing political fiction, poetry, and letters to the editor on social justice issues, attending conventions, serving in leadership, and taking the reins from Anthony in a pinch. She was instrumental in organizing suffrage associations here in Virginia as well as in New York State. Gage was both theoretician and activist. As the nation appeared to be moving headlong in the direction of civil war over the issue of slavery, these three women raised their voices ever more loudly with regards to its abolition. On the one hand, Gage helped organize medical supplies for Union soldiers. On the other, she expected these soldiers to take responsibility for the conditions under which they would fight to end slavery. It isn't until the 1870s that suffrage becomes the central focus of Stanton, Anthony, and Gage. Several associations were formed during this time. First, the Equal Rights Association, which ended up putting all of its efforts towards suffrage for African American men, leaving women out of the question. To rectify this, Anthony Stanton and other radical suffragists formed the National Women's Suffrage Association, which Gage also joined. The American Women's Suffrage Association held a place in the middle of these other two. Women who were willing to temporarily put aside the struggle for their rights in favor of the Negro's hour. This is the decade when women, Gage among them, tried to test the laws by attempting to vote. Anthony's attempt in the 1872 presidential election, though successful in the sense of casting her ballot, resulted in arrest and trial. And Gage provided aid and support throughout the ordeal. As various cases made their way through the courts, Matilda Gage helped people understand their role in history. For the nation's centennial celebrations, Gage prepared and Anthony delivered a Declaration of Women's Rights and Articles of Impeachment against the Government of the United States at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. It contained a warning echo of Abigail Adams' 100-year-old prediction. We are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by laws in which we have no voice or representation. As former Confederate leaders became refranchised, it begged the question why Congress couldn't enfranchise women. In some states, former felons were able to obtain their voting rights after having served their time. Now traitors were being forgiven. Why couldn't women vote? As an aside, I can just imagine the indignation that Matilda Gage would express to the Republicans of the Florida legislature today over their end run around the will of Floridians to restore voting rights to most convicted felons after their release from prison and completion of parole requirements. The campaign last year was successful at the ballot box. A bill introduced in March of this year and passed last week withholds re-enfranchisement until former felons pay back all court costs and fines. Are they ever going to be able to vote? After the Declaration of Women's Rights, the strategy was to keep attention on the issue, and petitions from women began accumulating in Washington, D.C., leading to the introduction of the Federal Suffrage Amendment in 1878. Tax resistance wasn't far behind. In the meantime, the three women undertook to edit a history of woman suffrage. The book was 10 years in the making and published in three 1,000-page volumes. In spite of a contract that defined roles and responsibilities, political and theoretical differences, as well as those over money and credit, between the three editors emerged, creating rifts that would never be resolved. Although Gage and Stanton had the writing roles, and Anthony the publication and marketing role, Gage never received credit for her co-authorship. Simply put, this project led to a falling out among the three, with Gage being pushed out by the other two. In fact, in the fourth of three subsequent volumes of the history, Anthony and journalist Ida Husted Harper gave Anthony credit for writing instead of Stanton and wrote Gage out completely, relegating Gage to the role of consultant for historical facts. Both Stanton and Gage had died by that time and could not defend themselves. Susan B. Anthony doesn't sound like such a great woman after all. one of the disagreements they had centered on what Stanton and Gage believed to be the ideological underpinnings of the denial of women's rights in church law. Stanton and Gage won out over Anthony, and a section entitled Woman, Church, and State was included at the conclusion of Volume 1. It became for Gage a preliminary study for her major work, Woman, Church, and State, published in 1893. Our reading this morning gives you a small example of Gage's style and the scope of her treatise. This 500-page tome traces the subjugation of women by the Christian Church, specifically, with its patriarchal structure and the subsequent enactment of these same oppressive attitudes and laws by the political state. Other examples of what Gage calls the patriarchate, I assume, would be subject to similar critique by Gage if she'd had as much access to their histories as she does with the Christian Church. Throughout her life, she challenged religious authority. She was, in adulthood, affiliated with Theosophists, who believed that supernatural events could be studied scientifically. Gage founded the Women's National Liberal Union after Anthony and Stanton merged their National Woman Suffrage Association with the more religiously conservative American Woman Suffrage Association. At a time when the religious right was growing, the Women's National Liberal Union brought together radical reformers of all kinds, including free thinkers, and you count yourselves among them, free thinkers, who commonly believed in the absolute separation of church and state. Throughout the fight for women's suffrage, Christian church leaders had opposed the suffragists. Sound familiar? Matilda Gage had broken with the Baptist church of her childhood in her middle teens, at a time when she had begun to question and challenge the worldviews of those around her. Her father had taught her to think for herself, and he assured her that he would be sharing a piece of his mind with that rascally set of Baptist church fathers. Reading Woman, Church, and State today, Gage's critique strikes me as incredibly far-reaching, thorough, and insightful. At the same time, I wonder how much of her interpretation would bear the impress of another 100 years of evolution in historical analysis. Would it all hold up under scholarly scrutiny today? I simply don't know. As Wagner summarizes, Gage's analysis held first that the foundation of woman's oppression was the church, and second, and most startling, that the foundation of the church was the oppression of women. Common law was based on canon law, firmly setting women legally, politically, socially, and economically in the subordinate position in which Christianity had placed them religiously. It would take a revolution beyond any seen yet in the world, Gage maintained, to free women. A few years after the publication of Woman, Church, and State, Elizabeth Cady Stanton published The Woman's Bible, a woman's interpretation of the Bible. This was a first in the arena of biblical criticism, interpreting the text from the perspective of a particular identity group. That is, if you set aside the fact that all interpretation prior to then had been done by white men. Because Gage was not involved in bringing forth this, Stanton's feminist interpretation, it lacked Gage's bold assertions of the church's responsibility for and complicity in clergy sexual abuse, child prostitution, and sexual slavery, all of which are discussed without hesitation in Woman, Church, and State in 1893. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Matilda Joslyn Gage, along with Lucretia Mott, were influenced by their experiences of and among the Haudenosaunee, Iroquois people of upstate New York. They were by no means the only reformers transformed by their interactions with and respect for Native Americans and their culture. Sally Roche Wagner was encouraged by members of the Native community to share what she had learned in the course of her research on early feminists. She wrote an interesting work titled Sisters in Spirit, Haudenosaunee Iroquois Influence on Early American Feminists. Gage had written extensively about the Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee Iroquois Confederacy over a 20-year period. This included calling out the government's breaking of treaties and speaking out against the racial oppression of Native Americans. Gage fully supported their sovereignty. She was able to draw parallels between the social position of white women and Native Americans as treated by federal and state laws. Likewise, contemporary Mohawk leader Tehane Torrens, Ray Fadden, draws parallels between how the church has subjugated women throughout history and how the church has oppressed Native Americans. Many of Gage's references to the matriarchate in woman, church, and state are based in her understanding of the Haudenosaunee governance structure and the equality of women and men. Gage was a product of her times, and her writing reflected this. While her analysis of racial oppression in particular was astute, her writing incorporated imagery that makes us cringe today. As Sally Roche Wagner states, Gage saw a long way. Her vision, however, wasn't perfect. Matilda Gage was adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation in 1893, the same year that Woman, Church, and State was published, and she went to trial for voting in a school board election. She was named Karonian Hawi, or She Who Holds the Sky. The adoption by the Wolf Clan gave her full voting rights in the Council of Matrons, yet she could not legally vote in our democratic society. When she died in 1898, Gage was working on a book about the Haudenosaunee. Matilda Jocelyn Gage's lifelong motto, which is engraved on her headstone in Fayetteville, reads, "There is a word sweeter than mother, home, or heaven. That word is liberty." On this Mother's Day, we take up Gage's standard, working for justice and liberty for all people around the world. In a world without end, may it be so. Please join with me now for a time of silence and meditation, followed by pastoral prayer. Settle yourselves. Make yourself comfortable with your feet on the floor, perhaps lightly holding your hands in your lap, and closing the petals of your eyelids over your eyes. Great Spirit, be with us and among us. You who bring sunshine as well as rain, know that it is easy to celebrate the good times, to lift up the joys, enjoy the relationships, the times when we can play together, whether it's hide and seek or graduation or visiting family and celebrating the natural world. This is easy. It is not nearly as easy to share our vulnerable moments and our vulnerabilities. Great Spirit, you bring rain to wash the world, to rehydrate us. Our tears are an expression of our love, flowing out of our eyes. Love that misses those who have died. Love that misses those with whom we have not been able to meet. Great Spirit of life and love, you know that by sharing our vulnerability, our hurts, our pains with each other, we are able to hold that together, to heal together. Because if one part of this human community is in pain or sickness, then all of us are suffering. Great Spirit, we are so thankful that you hold this beloved community, holding it gently, allowing us to share with each other the pain that we feel, as well as the joy. Amen. Blessed be, and namaste. Please rise now in body or spirit to sing our closing hymn, number 1028, Fire of Commitment. You may join hands with those around you who are willing to do so as we extinguish our chalice. We extinguish this chalice, for our worship has ended. Our service begins.